Okay, we call God's Judgment and Salvation, Micah 7, and it's more of a Bible study than a sermon, which actually the whole series has been, frankly. See, Bible study prepares for the sermon, but when you give the sermon as a Bible study, you actually haven't done the work properly because you're only halfway there. Bible study follows the order of the passage by and large. Bible study notes and explains each verse in order, and so Bible study monologues, like this one's going to be, is like an oral commentary. And that's not sermons, that's not preaching. Because a sermon makes a point, or maybe points, and it uses those parts of the passage necessary to demonstrate the point. And the point that it's making has to be the point of the passage. So in Micah 7, if I was preaching it, I would just look at verses 18 to 20, which stand alone as a kind of memory verse or memory passage, which could then be illustrated by verses 1 to 17. But verses 18 to 20 take us from Abraham via Moses to Jesus and contrasts the gospel to the current worldviews, contrasts God and Jesus to the gods of paganism. So if I was preaching this as a sermon, I really would be working on verses 18 to 20 and then illustrating it from verses 1 to 17. But I'm not doing that. I'm doing you a Bible study, which actually then takes you through Micah 7 in three sections, as you see on the outline, and I'll take you through each of the verses in turn. I know we haven't read it out loud the whole lot, but that's because we're going to work our way through it. Firstly then, living in the land under judgment, in chapter 7, verses 1 to 10. The word land is an important word. I think our Bible translators and our world doesn't understand the importance of the promised land. And the word land and the word earth is the same, but it's land that is being spoken of here. I think your normal presupposition of reading Jewish people, when they talk of the land, you should be thinking of Palestine, of the promised land, rather than thinking of the whole earth, which is where our translators nearly always take us. And what we have here is the sense of judgment that is coming upon the land. Verse 1, the land is cursed, a great famine. Woe is me, for I have become as when the summer fruit has been gathered, as when the grapes have been gleaned, and there's no cluster to eat, no first ripe fig that my soul desires. See, the land's ruined agriculturally. And when it happens, it's because of the judgment of God, because the people, well, the godly have perished. Verse 2, the godly has perished from the earth, see, from the land, and there is no one upright among mankind. They all lie in wait for blood, and each hunts the other with a net. Without God's people amongst God's people, then they turn to the savages of wanting to kill each other, hunting each other as with a net. And so what happens in the hierarchy, in the governments, in the controlling forces of society is corruption and bribery. Verse 3, their hands are on what is evil to do it well. The prince and the judge ask for a bribe, and the great man utters the evil desire of his soul. Thus they weave it together. And so the best of them, you see, is of no use. And worse, there are no watchmen in the day of judgment. The whole of Micah is written under the shadow of Assyrian conquest. And so the warning of the watchmen that the enemy is coming is a critical role that should be taken place, but no. The best of them is like a briar, the most upright of them, a thorn hedge. The day of your watchman, of your punishment, has come. Now their confusion is at hand. And so verses 5 and 6 tells the real collapse of society at every level, in the broader society as a whole, right down to the intimacy of family. Put no trust in a neighbour. Have no confidence in a friend. Guard the doors of your mouth from her who lies in your arms. For the son treats his father with contempt. The daughter rises up against her mother. The daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemy are the men of his own house. It's you the terrible plight that happened under communist regime in Russia, and I think in China today, where people were reporting their own family to the authorities. So you could never say what was in your mind, not to anyone, because you were never sure that the person you were speaking to was going to keep the secret of your heart. And so it has a terrible effect on trust. And without trust, there's no friendship. And without friendship, there's no society. There's no family life. I mean, it's an appalling circumstance when you trust no one. Now, the prophet, he's still living there in the land under judgment. And you see a couple of characteristics of such life, namely the suffering and the hope of salvation. See, it starts off in verse 1 with the suffering. Woe is me. Because when the land comes under judgment, God's people feel the effect of the judgment. The famine doesn't just come upon the unrighteous. God sends the rain on the righteous and the unrighteous, as Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. And so he suffers together with everyone else. The lack of trust, he will feel like everybody else. But verse 7 shows that there is a difference. But as for me, I will look to the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. So he looks to the Lord with confidence. But as with most godly living, it is a matter of delayed gratification. You know God will come. You know God will save. But you have to wait for God to come and to save in God's time, not in our own time. And that's difficult when you're living in the world of judgment, suffering with everybody else. And it becomes harder and harder to refute the devil's accusations when the salvation doesn't come and you wait another day and another day and another day. It's not exactly what was meant by Beckett in his play Waiting for Godot, but it does capture that sense in that play. Great play if you've never seen it. No one said you haven't missed much. It just goes on and on. All the time you're waiting for this character called Godot to turn up. And at the end of Act 1, he hasn't turned up, but you're sure he'll come the next time. So you then go through Act 2, and I won't spoil the end for you because there is no end. But here, there's a sudden movement takes place. As you come to the second section, where you see the salvation of the Lord. It's a sudden movement as his personal salvation turns into a national salvation. And we're called upon to see the salvation of the Lord. I've jumped ahead. I'm sorry. I haven't done with verses 8 to 10. Where the hope is spilled rightly out. So back up to verses 8 to 10. Where the vindication of the sinful takes place in verses 8 to 10. For unexpectedly, he indicates that he too is sinful and deserving of judgment. He said there in verse 8, rejoice not over me, O my enemy. When I fall, I shall rise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord will be a light to me. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him. Until he pleads my cause and executes judgment for me. He will bring me out to the light. I shall look upon his vindication. It's a little bit of a surprise. Verse 7 is such a great statement of faith and trust in God and hopeful expectation of salvation. But then you find that he too, the one who is waiting on the Lord, is a sinner like the rest. But he is looking to the Lord to vindicate him, to rescue him, to deal with him. But he's willing to do the time. Did you read last week in the papers about Senator Jackie Lambie and the quarrel she had at the Qantas? And she's been banned from Qantas for 6 months now because she swore and abused the staff at the one of the lounges. And Senator Lambie is one of the more interesting politicians in Australia. I think she's not really aligned to just party politics. And she speaks her mind and she wears a heart on her sleeve. And she's saying, well, I did the crime, and so I deserve to do the time. You know, she accepts the reality that she really did mess things around. She explains why she did. She had a dreadful day, it was a dreadful day, but she doesn't excuse it for that reason. She said, I did the wrong thing. I've apologised to those people. I'm writing another letter of apology to them. But yeah, I deserve to be banned for 6 months because I shouldn't have done what I did. So the psalmist recognises that he's a sinner and he deserves the judgment of God. But he's still looking to God to vindicate him. But he's warning his enemy. Doesn't say who the enemy is. He's warning his enemy not to rejoice over him. When you see me fall with everybody else, don't rejoice over me because I will be vindicated by God in verse 9. And she in verse 10 will be put to shame. Then my enemy will see and shame will cover her who said to me, where is the Lord your God? My eyes will look upon her, now she will be trampled down like the mire of the streets. You see, in the delayed gratification of waiting for God to come and vindicate, the unbeliever, the enemy, the oppressor, can keep on saying, well, where's God? Where's God? You talk about God coming to rescue. Where is he? You know, I thought God was going to come and say, how can there be a God and leave you suffering like you are? He says, well, I deserve it. But don't you rejoice over me like that, because God will vindicate me. And when that happens, you will be put down. It's like David, that, you know, you prepare a table before me, before the face of my enemies. People loving Psalm 23 are people who have not really thought about what it's saying. What it's saying is God's going to give me a feast while you stand by hungry looking. You know, it's the put down of the alternative that is being spoken of. And so she keeps on saying, where is your God? Well, she will be put to shame. Then there's this sudden movement as you move from personal salvation into national salvation. And you see the salvation of the Lord in the second section, verses 11 to 17. There's a day of rebuilding the city, presumably we're talking, the day of building up your walls. In that day, the boundary will be extended. In that day, they will come to you from Assyria and the cities of Egypt, and from Egypt to the river, from sea to sea and from mountain to mountain. But the earth, I take it, is still the land, will be desolate because of its inhabitants for the fruit of their deeds. So Jerusalem is going to be rebuilt, the capital city of the kingdom, which will stretch like David's kingdom from the sea to the river, the whole, what is called by the English the Middle East, but what is more accurately Southwest Asia. The whole land will be, but the land will still be desolate because the people's sinfulness has destroyed the fruit of the land. It's supposed to be a land flowing with milk and honey, but it's just going to be desolate. And so the shepherd is challenged. Now, some people will see the shepherd here as God, but I think it's the king, because the picture of the building of the Jerusalem and the establishment of the rule from Assyria and the cities of Egypt, etc., it's the kingdom that he's talking about. Shepherd your people with your staff, the flock of your inheritance, who dwell alone in a forest in the midst of a garden land. That's Hebron. Let them graze in Bashan and Gilead, as in the days of old. So the king is called to shepherd the people, the faithful who are hiding away in the forests, to gather them together to Bashan and to Gilead, not Hebron, it's Carmel they're in, isn't it? To gather them to Bashan, which are the best, most lush grazing areas in the whole area, the rich pasture lands like yesteryear. For God is going to confound the enemies in verses 15, 17. As in the days when you came out of the land of Egypt, I will show them marvellous things. The nations shall see and be ashamed in all their might. They shall lay their hands on their mouths. Their ears shall be deaf. They shall lick the dust like serpent, like the crawling things of the earth. They shall come trembling out of their strongholds. And they shall turn in dread to the Lord our God. And they shall be in fear of you. Well, it's an extraordinary little passage about the incoming of the Gentile nations to to seek the salvation that is that which comes to Israel. It's like the days of Egypt. And if you remember, Egypt were astonished, astounded at the great miracles that Jesus did, that God did in the plagues. And in the end, they gave their money and their jewelry to the Israelites to take. The Israelites plundered the Egyptians as they left the slavery. They didn't come out empty-handed. Well, likewise, when these people see God at work in the salvation of his people, then they will come confounded by how great God is and bow down and worship him. A little interesting phrase there, isn't it, that I will show them marvellous things. Where are we? As in the days of when you came out of the land of Egypt, I will show them marvellous things. The nations shall see and be ashamed of all their might. The nations are built on might, on strength, on armies, on wealth, on power. All kingdoms are like that. But they're going to be ashamed of that when they see the power and work of God in saving his people. It's an extraordinary thing. I came across a quote of Napoleon. I'm a little worried about using it publicly because I'm not sure about it. I've looked up, I tried to find its source, and I haven't been altogether good at doing that in the time. I've come some extraordinary quotes from Napoleon, but I've also come across websites which talk about the misquotes of Napoleon, and that Napoleon didn't say what people say he said, and so on. So I'm a little wary. I'd like to see it, and worse still, of course, it's been translated, and so. But I came across quite a few quotes, it would seem, of Napoleon saying great things about Jesus, extraordinary things about Jesus. Mind you, I also came along which said that Napoleon thought that Mohammedism was the best form of religion. But this quote goes like this: "Do you not know, Fortanes, what astonishes me most in this world? The inability of force to create anything. In the long run, the sword is always beaten by the spirit." Interesting observation for one of the great dictators of the world. Napoleon was the Adolf Hitler of his day. he was horrendous. But yet, it would seem from these other quotes and that one that he actually understood that he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. You actually don't build the kingdom that way. And that Jesus coming as the victim instead of the conqueror is the one who has built the kingdom. I can give you some other quotes later on. And so the chapter ends, and the book ends, with what I call the Micah pun in verses 18 to 20. It's the Micah pun because it's a pun on his name. Micah as a name means who is like Yahweh. And he is introduced in the first verse by the name Micah. And here in verse 18, you see, who is God like you is a pun on his name. And the answer, well, there is nobody like him. And the two things about God are love and faithfulness. Chesed and emeth. Now, I don't like chiasms. I find chiasms are one of those kinds of things that once you get to see a few, you find them everywhere, even when they're not. And in order to get people, in order to get the chiasm to fit, they leave bits out of the text. And so I don't like them. But I've printed this chiasm at the bottom of the sheet for you, because it does work, and the bits that they leave out actually are unimportant, insignificant bits. And the bit that it highlights is actually what the whole thing's about. That is, he pardons iniquity He casts away sins. He passes over transgression. He treads down iniquities. He doesn't retain his anger. He has compassion. Because he delights in steadfast love. The steadfast love of the Lord leads to these six other things put in two parallel sections. And I thought, well, if you're going to go with chiasms, this is as good a one as I've seen. I'm still not persuaded. However, whether it's there or not, I'm drawing your attention to the things that the steadfast love of the Lord does, haven't I? And that's clearly what the verse is about. It's the steadfast love of the Lord. And so it reminds us of the revelation to Moses in Exodus 34. And it reminds us of the revelation of God in Jesus. The Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us, full of love and faithfulness, full of grace and truth. And therefore, we would expect faith to be there. And lo and behold, there it is in verse 20. You will show faithfulness to Jacob and steadfast love to Abraham, so as you have sworn to our fathers from the days of old. So let me read this wonderful little finishing passage. Who is God like you, pardoning iniquity and passing over transgression for the treatment of his inheritance? He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in steadfast love. He will again have compassion on us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. He will cast all our sins into the depths of the sea. You will show faithfulness to Jacob and steadfast love to Abraham, as you have sworn to our fathers from the days of old. We live and stand on these two great words, love and faithfulness, grace and truth, that riddle all the way through the Old Testament, but are particularly built into the revelation of God to Moses in Exodus 34. This is the glory of God. Show me your glory, and God says, I will show you my goodness. And the goodness that he shows him is his love and faithfulness. And there is no God like that, because the other gods were fickle and fancy-free, and the other gods didn't love like God loves. And that's still the case to this day. And so here's the covenant was made with the patriarchs. He will fulfill his covenant because he is loving, he is faithful. And so that last three verses, you can chop them out of it, Micah. They make sense anyway. And they take you back from Abraham through Moses, through Micah, into Jesus. It's the great, one of the great themes, one of the backstories of the whole Bible. And it's this God who is loving and faithful who brings this judgment upon his people and upon the nations while rescuing and saving his servant. It's a lovely chapter, but if I was preaching it, I'd preach verses 18 to 20 and use the rest of the chapter as illustrative material. And if I was memorising any of it, I'd memorise verses 18 to 20. And the bit that speaks to my heart and your heart most clearly, even without, you know, the immediate context of Micah and Assyria, is verses 18 to 20. It's just a marvellous passage. The earlier chapter passage of chapter 6, what does the Lord require of you but to love justice and do? People often quote that one, but I don't think I've ever heard people quoting this one. And I think this is where the book heads us to. It's a great passage.